I'm Mark Labberton, president of Fuller Theological Seminary. Welcome to Conversing. Great joy today to welcome Dr. Broderick Leakes to Conversing. I'm so glad that he's our guest. Dr. Leakes is the Director of Counseling and Mental Health at the USC Student Health Center. He's also the Clinical Associate Professor of Psychiatry and the Behavioral Sciences at Keck School of Medicine. In fact, he's also an alum of Fuller Theological Seminary, both in his clinical psych degree and in a master's in theology. And it's just really such an honor to welcome you, Broderick, and I'm thrilled that you're with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you today.
When we first met, which was a few years ago, I had heard about you serving at USC and in a student health context, and I thought, oh my gosh, this is somebody I can't wait to meet. And the reason for that is partly that the longest period of my own ministry has been always in student or university contexts. Both now, obviously at Fuller, but for many, many years, working as a pastor alongside the campus of the University of California, Berkeley. So besides the rivalry between Cal and USC, it is also just a shared concern for students and for their welfare. And to get to meet and get a bit acquainted with not only a wonderful Fuller alum, but somebody who's doing such critically important work in the heart of a major university, in the heart of a major urban center like LA, is just a stacked up treat of many different kinds. Tell us a little bit about how you ever got to this particular role and what was your background and formation that brought you in this direction?
Sure. And just a quick note, it was such a pleasure when you came to visit me in my office. At the time, I was the assistant director and oversaw our training programs. And I had to pinch myself a couple of times when you were in my office. I've gotten a promotion since then, so my office is a little bigger now than it was then. But I was pinching myself. I'm like, the president of Fuller is literally sitting in my office talking with me right now. It's such a great conversation, and you were so humble and engaging. And so I really appreciated that time of connecting. And we talked a lot about a lot of different concerns and topics. And so anyway, just wanted to acknowledge
that was I remember it very fondly.
A lovely conversation. So I think, you know, historically, as a kid, I had many different career paths. At one point, I wanted to be an astronaut, NFL quarterback, wanted to play in the NBA. But the most consistent career path I had was I wanted to be a pediatrician. Ever since I was little, I wanted to help out kids, other kids, even my peers. And I think as I made it through high school and college, I really developed this real deep interest in psychology. In high school, I took an AP psychology course that really piqued my interest in psychology. And partly because of the content of the course, it was fascinating to learn about human behavior and how the brain worked and what motivated people. But also my teacher for that course was a real mentor to me, poured in a lot. He was a Latino male, so it was really nice to have a person of color who really took an interest in me and highlighted my skill set and really pushed me to excel. And so the combination of the course content plus the really inspirational teacher that I had, Mr. Benjamin Ibarra, really helped me kind of develop a love for psychology. I went to university at Baylor, university in Waco, Texas, and I started off in biology, and I just didn't love school anymore for various reasons. And I really had to take a hard look at myself and figure out what was happening. Where did that spark go? Where did that passion for learning go? And so I sat down and tried to remember the last time I was really in love with learning and school. And I looked back to, you know, my last year of high school. And that's when I made the decision to switch to psychology, because that was the time I really remember just having a passion and love for the subject matter. And it fit naturally, you know, as I look back over my life, even as a kid, you know, I just remember times when some of my friends would come and share deep things with me, stuff that they hadn't really even shared before, said out loud before. And just even as a youngster, having kind of significant conversations with others. And for the most part, people really found me trustworthy. And so I think it was a natural kind of evolution to get to my current career.
Was Baylor overall a good experience for you? You stayed there, did you, and finished your degree? I wasn't quite sure how that part went.
Yeah, I was at Baylor throughout my entire undergraduate career. I loved it there. I had a great, great experience. I loved it too much my freshman year. That's probably why my grades were suffering a little bit. But it was a great community. I think, you know, it's not unlike other predominantly white institutions where I think as a young African-American male, a student of color, really wanting to find your place and find a community and a sense of connection. It was interesting, you know, I did really well in high school and graduated near the top of my class. And I was in AP classes, gifted and talented courses, but something about transitioning to that next level, you start doubting yourself.
Right.
And, you know, what do other people think about me? And do they think I'm here for affirmative action, or what stereotypes do they hold? And it takes up a lot of mental energy. You're already walking into those settings with those kind of thoughts. And then sometimes those thoughts get confirmed in terms of comments or statements that people make. And so I think for some people of color, you raise your hand, you're like, okay, I have to definitely know the exact answer to this question. I can't be wrong. And even when I do answer it, I need to use the best language possible to speak the Queen's English, to not come off a certain way. And of course, as you grow and mature, that becomes less and less of a concern. But I think entering a new space and knowing that there are stereotypes and biases that exist, you try to lessen the likelihood of that. So it's draining at times, but I think once I was able to find a home and a really nice community that allowed me to kind of branch out and kind of own my skill set a little bit more as I navigated. It is quite the odd experience to be the only person that looks like you in most of your classrooms, or very few that look like you. And I had a really lovely, you know, I talked about mentoring in high school. I had an amazing mentor, Pearl Beverly. She was the director of multicultural activities at Baylor. And she was, I call her my Baylor mom, but she infused such confidence and such motivation that really allowed us to operate in our skill set and navigate the campus as if we belonged, which we do, but she made us believe that we actually did belong.
Right, right. It's something we'll come back to a little bit later when we talk more about your time at USC, but one of the things that just strikes me is how incredibly powerful that small window into that really vast and defining season is, because it sounds like you found, as you said, the right community, the right mentors, the right surrounding structures that made it possible for you to take advantage of it. But not everybody does that in any environment, and especially in such a predominantly white environment. When you're under such a gun for performance, especially, very intense combination. Obviously, you must find this a lot with students that you're dealing with now.
Yeah, it's interesting you used the term under a gun, and I can definitely share situations if we get on the topic of interactions with law enforcement, some pretty traumatic and defining moments in my own personal life around that. But there is a lot of pressure, and you want to do well, not only for yourself, but, you know, you want to do well for your family, and you want to represent the culture well. And I think walking in knowing that there are some really lovely people sitting next to you, but also walking in knowing that there are some people who have some pretty negative thoughts about your existence is taxing. And, you know, there's studies on stereotype threat and other kind of psychological phenomena that show how those situations kind of impact performance. So it's vitally important to have a community and a base that kind of affirms who you are, affirms that you actually belong, so you can go out and do what it is that you're called to do and what you're there to do.
But seriously, Broderick, I mean, just to hear you say that, when I know that you are so gifted and skilled and called and committed to all that you're doing, the thought that all of that is your experience, of course, does not surprise me, because I know that's how it goes. But it just really does make me sick to hear you describe that. I don't want to move on quite yet because of what you've just referred to. So just tell us what you would want to tell us about some of the challenging moments, whether with police or with students or whatever. I want to just be clear that I'm not here trying to either set you up or set up anybody else, including Baylor. I'm just wanting you to give us a window into your experience during that period of your life.
Yeah. You know, it was interesting. I'll share a couple of different stories that will maybe help highlight some of the experience. I remember going to a local mall in Waco. It was during my freshman year. And so, you know, my friends and I, we all went to the mall together to go get some clothes and items for school. And, you know, growing up in the South, there's kind of this Southern hospitality is a real thing. And yes, this idea of relationship and connection. So if you make eye contact with someone, you know, you at least acknowledge their presence or, you know, speak to them. And if you don't get that reciprocated, then you know something is wrong. It's very clear, okay, this person has an issue with me. And that's a little more hard to navigate in California, because it's not the same kind of norms. I remember going to the local mall and I said hi to the checkout person and they said nothing. They literally just stared at me, did not greet me, did not say, how you doing today, just said nothing. And I thought that was pretty odd and quite jarring, actually. And then I pulled out my Baylor credit card, which I regret to this day that I got, but it was a formal credit card company that had Baylor branding on it. And yes, as a young freshman coming in with not a lot of money, I jumped on the opportunity to get a credit card so I can actually go out and purchase some things. But the credit card is branded with Baylor's logo. And so when I pulled out the card, the person's demeanor immediately shifted. Very friendly, very talkative, and just, oh, I went to Baylor. And it was striking to me in that moment that 5 seconds ago, you said nothing to me and actually had a scowl on your face. But now that you know that I'm at Baylor in university or not just someone from the city, that now I deserve respect. Now I deserve to kind of be engaged with in a different manner. And there's countless stories. I would wear my Baylor apparel just around because we knew we would get treated differently if we were affiliated with the university. And that happens now at USC where I literally have some of my students say, I wear my ID around my neck. And LA is very fashion conscious. So, you know, you don't see a lot of people walking around with big lanyards and IDs on. But the students were so frustrated and so disappointed of getting checked every time they went into a space like, oh, are you a student or do you belong here? And seeing their Caucasian counterparts just walk right in without kind of any checking. And so to solve that issue, they just wear their ID around to lessen the likelihood, one, of just getting slowed down, but two, that's a psychological hurt. That's a little poke every time someone questions your existence in a space.
Right.
So going back to Baylor, I think the most I quickly share two things. One, I remember walking around and a lot of times the first question a lot of people, students and adults alike, would ask, like, oh, well, are you an athlete? What sport do you play? And of course, you know, I would have loved to have played, you know, D1 sports and be on the team. But, you know, and also for them to think I had some type of athletic body, you know, was somewhat of a compliment. But I think the thing that hurt when I said, oh, no, you know, I'm here on an academic scholarship or I'm here for academic reasons, and the sense of surprise and, oh, wow. Oh, OK, well, that's amazing, you know, was, again, hurtful in the sense of.
Of course it was.
In your mind, the only reason I can be here is because of some athletic ability versus an intellectual ability or academic ability. And again, you know, some people might say, oh, well, you know, you're being sensitive or making a big deal of that. And I'm like, no, that communicates something. That tells you what people think of you. That tells you what category you're being placed in and what box people are putting you in. And I think the last thing, you know, me and my friends, we, you know, Waco is centrally located in Texas. And so a lot of times we would go out to various cities to go to parties or just different events that other schools were hosting. And so me and my friends, we went to a party in Austin at the University of Texas. And after the party, we were going to go crash at one of my friend's fraternity brother's house. And on the way there, they lived a little bit outside the city. And, you know, Central Texas, it was kind of hill country. And we were kind of outside the city limits, pitch black, not a lot of lights or anything. And this police car pulled up behind us. And it was a four-lane highway. And so if the police car needed to, they could have just kind of gotten to the lane and passed us. But they followed us for quite a while. And we were just like, why are they behind us? Like, why are they on our tail for so long? And they finally hit the lights and pulled us over. And at that moment, we were caravanning. So the other car in the caravan pulled over as well that was in front of us. And the police officers come and they're asking us these questions and kind of questioning what we're doing out. And one could say they were just kind of checking out the scene. But I think as young African-American males, you know that you're targeted. You know there's a such thing as driving while Black. You know that there's a higher suspicion of someone pulling you over just because. And so I think, you know, my friends in the car were getting a little frustrated with the questioning and what was kind of going on. And not, you know, a week before that, they actually had guns pulled on them by police officers who... They were walking home from the library and one of the local fast food places had just gotten robbed. And so my friends are walking home from the library to our apartment complex and the police pull up on them and kind of pull guns and say they fit the description, which a lot of times means you're an African-American male. And so they had just come off a situation where they were already frustrated and feeling really hurt by that interaction. And then less than a week later, we're in the same boat again. And so they're expressing their frustration to the police, like, why are you bothering us? What's going on? So you can tell the police are getting a little frustrated as well. And so they make us get out of the car and they start to search the car. And I don't know what they found under the seat at the time, but they yell out something and then chaos ensues. And so it's probably four of us in the car. I think maybe four or five of us. And we first get pulled over. One police car comes up. About 5 to 10 minutes later, another police car comes up. And so we have two police cars with us now. And they yell out something and they pull their guns and they say, get on the ground, get on the ground, get on the ground. So we get on the ground. And then at this point, two more police cars pull up. One is a K-9 unit and then another car. So we have four official police vehicles out now. And I'm closest to whatever it is that they found. So whatever they found under the seat, I'm the nearest person to this. And so the officer puts his gun right above my ear and forces me down on the ground. And I don't know if you've ever had a gun pulled on you, but it was the most eerie feeling because in my mind, I'm like, I have no control over my life right now. 5 inches away is a bullet. And all this guy has to do is pull this trigger and I'm gone. And he's pressing it, you know, and it hurts and it's painful and I'm on the ground and they handcuff us. And the young lady who actually owned the car, because we're caravanning, and so all the guys rode together, the young ladies rode together. She runs back and they put the gun on her because she's running to the car. And so she's like, this is my car, what's happening? So it turns out, I think they found a knife that she kept under her seat for protection. And they told her that, you know, you can't have this in the front. You need to put it in the trunk. So they run all of us through the system. And of course, nothing comes up. And so we're on the ground for at least 20 minutes, if not more, as they're kind of doing their process. And I thought I could die that night. And I really thought they were going to beat us up. I think the only thing that really saved us was that the other car full of the young ladies was also pulled over. And they finally let us up because, of course, there was nothing on their record for any of us because we're just young college kids going to crash after a party. So they put us back in the car and then they start trying to have small talk. And one of my friends who was driving was like, why did you pull us over? Like, why did you pull us over? And the police officer stopped and just said, oh, you know, you guys were swerving. And every Black person on the planet, if you see a police officer, you move into driver's test mode. Your hands are at 10 and 2. Everything is perfect because we know there's a high likelihood. And so we said, no, we weren't. You know, you guys followed us for a long time. We were not swerving. Why did you pull us over? And finally, they said, well, the people in the back seat kept turning around, so you look suspicious. And we replied, well, we're in the middle of a country road in the middle of nowhere. and you were on our bumper. And if you need to go around, you could have went around. You followed us for a long time. And that's why we were looking around trying to figure out why you were on our bumper. So they let us go. And I'll end with this. We make it to our destination. And my friend, who is like the life of the party, one of the funniest guys you'll ever meet, he just goes outside. I can sense something is wrong with him. And so I follow him outside, and he's sitting on the steps of the apartment complex just bawling. And in that moment, it hit me, because the people in that car, one of my friends that was in the car is an occupational therapist now. Another friend is a surgeon. Another friend is an executive in the insurance industry. And then myself, clinical psychologist, PhD. And, you know, we were the younger versions of ourselves. We weren't getting in trouble. We weren't committing crimes. We weren't doing anything that demanded kind of police presence. But in that moment, none of that mattered because we were Black. In that moment, we were seen as criminals that needed to be checked out, needed to have guns pulled on them, needed to be handcuffed and laying on the ground. And I think when I saw my friend crying, I think all of that weight of what that actually meant hit him in that moment, because it didn't matter what we accomplished. It didn't matter who we were as people. We were seen a certain way. And that persists to this day. And I want to be clear, I have no issues with upstanding police officers. My uncle is a high-ranking police officer in Tennessee. My cousin and my brother are both in the police academy as we speak. And so I have a respect for law enforcement, but there is a pattern. There is a reality that we face daily. I just got pulled over not too long ago, and the officer said, "Oh, you were driving serpentine." I was like, "That's a creative use of the word," but and pulled me over. Yeah, just to check me out. And I was at a conference in D.C. not too long ago, and I went and visited my friends who actually graduated from Fuller. One of my best friends is an Episcopal priest out in DC area. His wife was driving me home back to my hotel, and we got pulled over, and literally 5 police cars pulled us over. Like, one pulled us over and 4 more came, and she was beside herself. She's like, "I don't understand, like, why are there so many police cars?" And I said, "Look, you are a white woman in a car with a Black man late at night. They think something is happening to you." And she just couldn't understand why there was such a presence. And I get back to the hotel, and some of my colleagues are there, and it's a national conference, so some of my colleagues are there. And I'm like, "You guys would not believe what just happened to me." And they're like, "Oh, you were in that car. We were trying to figure out what that person did so wrong to have that many police there." I was like, "Oh, we were just riding." And so this is a daily kind of thing that happens. And it takes a lot not to lose faith in the system. It takes a lot not to walk around and want to just reset this whole thing because of the daily occurrences that happen. And then it's quite maddening when you know this is your lived experience. You know that this happens. And if anyone's going to be protected from this, is me. You know, I'm a PhD, the director of a large center, a professor. So if it's happening to me, imagine what's happening to people in highly policed areas. And it's maddening when people try to explain it away or dismiss it or say it's not real. It's like, am I in a fairy tale land? Is this La La Land where, like, it just gets dismissed as if it's, you must have done something to kind of elicit right. this response. And it's quite demoralizing at times.
I'm Mark Labberton. You're listening to Conversing, a production of Fuller Studio. So for those who don't know the location of USC, I just want to come to that because I want to stay on the same theme, Broderick. USC is right in the heart of Los Angeles, and it is surrounded by, I'm sure, a mixed population, but a significant African-American, Latino population for sure. It's a wealthy school, and it's a school that has, I think, a lot of sensitivity about its surrounding environment and how to contribute to the surrounding environment of LA. That's always been a source of both strength and, I think, at times controversy about how USC has seen itself. But eventually you go to graduate school, you eventually graduate, you start later in your job at USC, and now you're working in a context where I would think all this is made just all that much more daily. Or does it seem more daily in that context than it did, for example, in a Baylor context?
I think here at USC it is fascinating, and I hope it's coming across that I love my time at Baylor. I really grew as a person there. It is a wonderful institution. If I could go back and do it all over again, I would pick Baylor every time because of the relationships I built, the education I received, the opportunities and the experiences that I had. But I think, you know, it is in Central Texas. And so it's kind of expected that you're going to run into some of those difficulties. It's unfortunate that that's an expectation and a reality, but it's like this is part of the cost of living in certain areas. I think when it happens in Los Angeles, which is a cultural mecca that has so much diversity and so many different people, it actually stings a little bit more here than it did, you know, back home in Texas, because you're under this false illusion that the people here are more, they've arrived, or they're more sensitive to these things. And on a grander scale, you can debate whether that's true or not, but it still happens here. And I think that it shows that no matter the makeup of where you are, that these issues still persist and that they're still very much salient in the daily experience that we live.
Broderick, we could stay just on this theme, both because of your own experience and also because of what's happening in our nation. But I do want to go on and have you tell us a little bit more about your work at USC, which is its own fascinating further window into this. So you come and join what is, in any university these days, a growing need and demand for mental health services in a university. And certainly in a highly pressurized environment, a highly racially diverse environment, a very moneyed competitive environment like USC, there's so many different things that are all going on at the same time. And I know that the need for expanded services at USC in mental health has been part of what you've had to develop because of how much need there is for students to be able to seek and find the right kind of mental health services. So for those who don't follow what's happening on campuses, give us a brief little overview of what's happening on campuses in general, but focus, if you would, on just USC, a description of the mental health needs of emerging young adults.
Sure. Across the country, most university counseling centers are experiencing a significant increase in demand for services. The mental health needs of the students are varied and complex. And I think our old models of care and our old staffing ratios aren't able to keep up with the ever-increasing demand and the need for access. And so USC is not immune from that. And so part of my job is trying to figure out how we can increase access, increase support for the students who are really struggling. And not only are more and more students coming into the door, but they're coming with more serious mental health concerns than before. More across the country, this is common. Also a higher increase in suicide ideation and suicidal gestures. So, you know, we're kind of in a situation where we're trying to see more students, but also they're coming in with significant concerns. And one way of thinking about it, you know, some people have said there's a bimodal distribution going on. So we have more students coming in, and definitely there's a subset of that group who are at risk for various reasons for harm to themselves. But we also have this other mode where a lot of students have been socialized their entire life to see a therapist. Like, if you have an issue, talk to a therapist. And so there's been so much work against decreasing stigma in mental health that most of the concerns that come up for people, they're like, oh, I'll go talk to a therapist. And of course, right, we would love for them to come and talk to us. That doesn't mean every concern that is raised needs a professional. So what we're having is all of these students are trying to get through the door at the same time. So our high acute students with significant risk and our students with more traditional concerns are all trying to get in the door together. And then we have to figure out how to meaningfully support the students with kind of more traditional or lower levels of risk, while also providing some pretty significant wraparound services for those students who are high risk and could be in danger of hurting themselves or others. And so that's the dilemma dilemma that we're in, and schools across the country are trying to figure it out. USC is unique in that it's such a competitive school. You know, you have some of the best and the brightest coming in, and there's this sense of competition. There's this sense of missing out where the person sitting next to me just got this amazing internship and they're flying to New York for the summer. This person on the other side of me has this amazing internship and they're actually going to be in Tokyo for the summer and I haven't secured an internship yet. Mm-hmm. Or there's this sense that if I'm not the CEO of a Fortune 500 company or the senior editor of a magazine right after graduation, then somehow I failed. And of course, I'm kind of exaggerating that a little bit, but that's the sense right. that we get sure from a lot of yeah. students. And so the other factor is that students are coming in burnt out already because of how competitive it is to get into some of the top tier universities. And so I remember high school was somewhat of a challenge, but it wasn't stressful. You know, I felt like, you know, we had fun, we had to do our work and we wanted to get into a good school. Whereas now, it feels like they've already been through college and now they're starting again. And so they're coming in stressed and burnt out and tired. So it's a perfect storm for the situation that we're facing. Mm. And it's a challenge. You know, we want to serve the students well. We want to help them meet their life and academic goals. But there's such a flood of demand and we have to get really creative with service delivery models. Fortunately, at USC, there's resources. And so the president and the provost have committed funding to expand our services. When we entered into the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences, our chair, Dr. Siegel, has been instrumental in expanding our services as well. And so USC has definitely put his money where his mouth is in terms of wanting to support the students. But it's a tough road that we're all in. And I think it's frustrating for me as director of the service because I see how deeply my faculty and staff providers care for the students. I see the hours that they're putting in. I see that a lot of times they spend more time with the students than their own families. And sometimes I think that the outside community doesn't recognize that this is a national kind of crisis. And sometimes that word gets overused. I'll say a national situation that we're in where we're trying to figure out how to best serve the students. And I think sometimes it gets read as people don't care about the mental health needs. And I think it's the opposite. But I do think we're trying to catch up to the demand across the country.
Right. It's a pretty staggering level.
Yeah.
Then you add two more things on top of that. So you add to the normal stress and hyper-stress that there is, and then you add COVID-19, and then you add protests and demonstrations in response to the recent killings.
Yeah.
So how does that complexify the picture even more?
So imagine you are trying to survive school and do your best, and then life just gets uprooted. You know, COVID hit, and students are scrambling, trying to figure out how they're going to get home, what are they going to do about classes. A lot of our students are struggling financially. And so this idea of kind of everything going to online education or even getting their healthcare services through telehealth. Some people didn't have the technological capability to do so, or even if they had a laptop or a computer, their Wi-Fi or their internet wasn't as strong at home. And then just the natural anxiety and fear about your physical health and where you're going to catch COVID. And then also family members are dying and people are sick. And so it was a lot, you know. And the other thing that I think that wasn't, a lot of people didn't think about it initially, but, you know, for some, school was a reprieve from their normal life.
You know,
I came from a very loving family and I had a great, but we struggled financially. My college apartment was better than my house, you know? Mm-hmm. And so think about some of these students who are coming from certain environments where it was their oasis and it was a place of peace for them. And then having to go back into some pretty tough environments, some traumatic environments, some abusive environments, you know, and if I'm a student, I'm like, okay, I'm prepping myself for June. I'm going to go back home. But now all of a sudden I have to go back home in March and I really didn't want to go home. That's a tough kind of pill to swallow. And then the other difficulty was that we weren't able to offer the same level of service, at least on the mental health side, because of licensing laws. So if you were not physically located in California, we couldn't provide therapy to you. And so you may have established an amazing relationship with your therapist and were making a lot of great progress. Maybe you're working with a psychiatrist as well, and you had a support system here. You go back home to, you know, North Dakota, you can't see your California therapist anymore, and you don't have that same access. So we had to get really creative in terms of ways of still supporting those students, but it was a lot.
Wow. And then you have the addition of Black killing. So for Black students, how has all of that added yet another layer? In some ways, as you said, there's a kind of normativity about this. But on the other hand, there's a obviously not a normativity to the protests and the demonstrations and so forth. So how does that add another layer?
Yeah, you know, I think as students try to navigate this world, and when I meet with students individually or when we have group discussions, there's this sense that we hope things are getting better. We know that we don't have the same experience as our grandparents or great-grandparents or maybe even our parents. We know it's a different world that we're living in now, but there's still something kind of amiss. There's still something kind of going on that doesn't feel, you know, quite right. And, you know, students talk a lot about feeling part of the USC community or not, and feeling included in some spaces and not. And so when you have these events that kind of show you that this stuff is still going on and this stuff is still happening and people are dying. And then it really hurts when you start seeing yourself in those people who are dying and recognizing that there's not a lot of separation between, you know, you being in one of those situations versus this person. And again, I think the narrative is, oh, well, these are criminals or these are people who are out doing bad things. And even if you do believe that, that somehow they're engaged in activities that they shouldn't be engaged in, I do think we have a justice system. I think we're past the days of shoot to kill and justice is served all in that one moment. There is an actual process that I think we would all want to be able to engage in if we're engaged in those activities. But there's been so many situations where people who were just walking down the street had a very similar kind of exchange and interaction. So I think for the students, it gets demoralizing because you're like, it feels like we should be past this, but we're not. And then it kind of confirms like that little sixth sense that you have that something is not quite right. It's like all these instances, you feel it in your bones, but then when you get these situations that happen, it brings it together. I will say on the flip side though, I think that each generation has their stake and their influence on how we move forward as a country. The current generation of students and young people, they have a lot of passion. They're very educated. They know history. They're mobilizing in ways that, you know, we've never seen before because of social media and other avenues. And so I have a lot of hope. It pains me that when I see them crushed, it pains me when I see them heartbroken because I have an 11-year-old son and I have a 1-year-old daughter and I don't want them to deal with this stuff. The unfortunate reality is that they are, but I think with the amount of energy that's going out right now and how brilliant our young people are and how energetic and mobilized they are, I think we can push the needle a little bit further. I just attended a Black Lives Matter rally last weekend and it was powerful. The students organized it. There were a ton of people there. There was so much energy and passion and so many different folks there. I was so touched by the amount of allies that were there, our Caucasian brothers and sisters, our Asian brothers and sisters, our Latino, Latinx brothers and sisters were there. And so I was really inspired. So I think, you know, they're going to push the needle, but they are in pain. They are hurt. They are angry. And I think they're going to demand some changes.
So here you are in this vortex, which is the thrill of getting to talk to you and the importance of the vocation that you're in and the training and skills and personal experience that you've had. And all of that just feels so providential to me and rich and wonderful. And yet to stand in that place as a Christian, both in terms of the rigor of necessary honesty and truth telling, isn't always what the church has groomed. And you live in both identification with elements of hopelessness, I'm sure. On the other hand, you're wanting to be in some way a genuine encourager of hope in a meaningful therapeutic context, which of course is not anything like a Band-Aid. So how do you hold those two things together and bring them to bear in such an important place at such a powerful time?
You know, I ask myself that question a lot, Mark, especially as a mental health provider. You know, I'm dealing with this stuff on a personal level.
Right.
I think about situations that I've kind of described before with my own interactions and some of the messages I got growing up that were on the negative side about my identity. I think about my kids often, and I pride myself on being able to cope and handle a lot of complex, stressful situations. And I think partly how I'm wired helped me kind of advance in my career. But I was on a conference call and I had to turn the camera off. I was literally crying in the middle of a meeting because I was so heartbroken and just grieving the state of affairs that we're in right now. And so I have to manage my own stuff. Then go out and try to run an organization and then provide support for others to help them get through. And so I try to engage in some self-care to make sure that I'm taking care of myself. I try to connect with my community. I try to limit how much media that I'm consuming because that 24/7 news cycle, you know, I need to step back sometimes to be able to function and provide that leadership and support and encouragement to others. And then I think from a spiritual standpoint, I know who I serve. I know that God has plans for this world. And at Fuller, you know, we kind of discussed this concept of the kingdom of God is already and not yet.
Yes.
And kind of this idea that we're moving towards something. And maybe it's not the reality now. Maybe it's not where we want it to be now. But I firmly believe that God will bring about justice. God will bring about healing. God will bring about community. And if we can get our act together, maybe we can help out. And the other piece is, you know, I was listening to this speaker, and of course, this is a famous quote, but the arc of the universe bends towards justice. And I firmly believe that. And so even though as I'm looking at what's right in front of me, it seems dire, even though when I look across and see all the grief and how difficult these conversations are, how difficult the situation we're in, I have to rely on what I know God has done historically in this world, what God has done for me personally, and also what I have faith that what God will do moving forward in the future. And so that grounds me, that gives me hope, that gives me purpose. And it's not this Pollyanna, oh, God's going to make it okay. I firmly believe that God will intervene. And we as his people need to intervene to bring about the reality that we want to see.
Broderick, I think I've said to you before how grateful I am for how God has made you and for the way that he's attended to your life and nurtured you and given you great ways of developing your skills and gifts. And I just, again, want to just say how honored I feel to be able to have this conversation, because I can't think of anything that is more urgent than standing in the vortexes of the places that you're trying to serve in a context like USC. And it's complicated, it's fraught, it's painful, it's increasing in its intensity. And just from my point of view, and you are there, and that is a source of great encouragement to me. And it's not because I think you hold solutions to all the great problems. Obviously, nobody does that. But you stand there with such humanity and faithfulness and humility and wisdom. So I just wanted to say thank you for this conversation. It could go on for hours because there's so much more worth exploring. And I hope we can have you back another time. But thank you very, very much for this conversation today.
It was my honor, and thank you for creating the space.
You've been listening to a production of Fuller Studio. Fuller Studio provides articles, podcasts, videos, and other resources for a deeply formed spiritual life. Subscribe on your favorite podcast app or visit us at fuller.edu/studio.